Throughout the year of 2024, North Korea has been doing things that would normally elicit an enormous amount of attention from the outside world. But due to the international news being focused on the more pressing ongoing hot conflicts in Ukraine and the Middle East, North Korea's recent developments have gone underreported on for now. But they appear to be staging themselves for a major incident in the near to medium-term future that could see them returning back to the top of the global headlines sooner than you think. It began in the beginning of 2024 in January, when North Korea's supreme leader, Kim Jong-un, formally called for an alteration to the North Korean constitution to remove all of Pyongyang's commitments to a peaceful reunification of the Korean peninsula. And even further, he had North Korea's constitution be changed to label South Korea as the nation's, quote, primary foe and invariable principal enemy, end quote. To get the point across even further, he then ordered the Arch of Reunification, a monument constructed back in 2001 in Pyongyang that symbolized the goal of eventual peaceful Korean reunification, to be blown up and destroyed. These moves, in effect, eliminated the decades-old concept of the peaceful reunification of Korea from North Korea's official national policy. A major legal and political shift that was considered to be so alarming and unprecedented that it led to two highly respected longtime North Korea analysts, Robert L. Carlin and Siegfried S. Hecker, to write an essay where they concluded that Kim Jong-un had already made the strategic decision to go to war with the South, just as his grandfather Kim Il-sung had decided on war more than seven decades ago in 1950 that led to the Korean War. They argued in this paper that they do not know when or how Kim will ultimately decide to pull the trigger that will launch the next Korean War, only that they believe his decision on war has already been made. Now, all of that may seem like a huge exaggeration to you at first. After all, just about everybody who's even remotely familiar with North Korea is used to the fact that North Korea basically threatens war with South Korea or the United States on a seemingly daily basis. And these reports of imminent war with North Korea have basically been routine for decades now. It is the quintessential modern geopolitical example of the world constantly crying wolf. Perhaps for so long that most of the outside world has grown apathetic and no longer takes the risk of a real war with North Korea seriously. But there's a growing number of intelligence analysts who are cautioning that this time is truly and frighteningly different. In February, Kim reportedly told his country's Ministry of Defense that the altering of the North Korean constitution had given him the legal right to annihilate South Korea whenever he wanted. And even more recently in October, North Korea symbolically blew up their own roads and rail lines that connected the country to South Korea, severing the physical links between them that had been built during calmer times in the 2000s. And all of this comes in an atmosphere where the North has been conducting all-time high record numbers of ballistic missile tests, is sending millions of artillery shells and other munitions to feed the Russian war machine in Ukraine, recent reports of potentially thousands of North Korean soldiers being prepared for actual physical deployments to Ukraine, and recently unprecedented military cooperation between Pyongyang and Moscow that is seeing God knows what modern Russian military technology filtering its way into the Korean People's Army. For many decades now, there has been a certain logic regarding America and South Korea's confrontational relationship with North Korea. It dates back to about 1991, when North Korea's former patron and chief supporter, the Soviet Union, collapsed, which threw North Korea into utter economic chaos. Over the years that followed, the qualitative differences between North Korea's and South Korea's armed forces accelerated into a runaway pace, with North Korea's armed forces remaining frozen in time in the Soviet era, and South Korea's armed forces continuing to advance and modernize, first with American equipment, and then with their own advanced home-built modern equipment as well. It quickly got to the point where it became obvious that South Korea's armed forces and the roughly 30,000 US troops deployed to safeguard South Korea possessed overwhelmingly superior technology and conventional firepower to North Korea. To the point where it became obvious to everyone that if North Korea ever attempted a forceful takeover of South Korea again, the same way they had tried in 1950, there would be no other possible outcome other than the complete destruction of the North Korean regime. With a disintegrated Soviet Union and a cautiously rising China and an overwhelmingly dominant American position globally, North Korea knew that it had no other choice available to it other than diplomacy. And so, the North entered into a decades-long quest to normalize its relations with the United States in order to secure its own stability and legitimacy. And at the same time, knowing that it could never compete with the South or the US conventionally, and fearful of its potential future without US normalization, North Korea pursued its own nuclear weapons program as a secondary fallback option to rely upon for stability and security in case diplomacy with the US ultimately failed. But that simultaneous nuclear program strained Pyongyang's ability to actually normalize its relations with Washington, who was loath to see a regime like the North's acquire a nuclear weapons arsenal. Diplomatic talks were made, but progressed slowly, and became exponentially more difficult after 2006, when North Korea successfully tested its first nuclear bomb. From that point onwards, North Korea developed their nuclear weapons as a sort of bargaining chip. They wanted to normalize their relations with the United States and end the crippling economic sanctions that had been applied to them first. And then they would give up their nukes afterward. While the United States essentially wanted the opposite. They wanted them to give up their nukes first before relations would be normalized and sanctions relaxed. But North Korea didn't necessarily trust the US to honor that agreement after their nukes were surrendered. Especially after prior incidents in Iraq in 2003 and Libya in 2011, where the US led military interventions against the dictatorial regimes of Saddam and Gaddafi after they'd already abandoned their own nuclear weapons programs. This dilemma led to a building diplomatic stalemate as North Korea continually advanced its nuclear weapons capabilities in order to make giving them up all the more enticing to Washington, but which led to increasing fears in the US and the outside world of what North Korea could do with those weapons. North Korea didn't trust the US to honor its side of the bargain if they gave up their nukes first, while the US increasingly didn't trust North Korea to honor their side of the bargain if they normalized relations and eased sanctions first. Fearing that North Korea would ultimately just keep their nukes or continue expanding their capabilities with increased trade opportunities. This decades-long diplomatic deadlock eventually came to a climax in February of 2019 at the Sofitel Legend Metropole Hotel in Hanoi, Vietnam, which served as the venue for the second high-level in-person meeting between Kim Jong-un and then-US President Donald Trump. Kim poured just about everything he had into this meeting with the ultimate goal of achieving what Pyongyang had been seeking for decades since the early 1990s, a normalization of its relations with the United States. But the talks between him and Trump in Hanoi quickly broke down on just the second day, and Trump left the summit early without reaching any agreement of any kind. Both sides blamed the other for the breakdown, and the failure obviously placed a huge psychological burden onto Kim personally. In his final letter that he sent to Trump only a few months later in August of 2019, he wrote, quote, "If you do not think of our relationship as a stepping stone that only benefits you, then you would not make me look like an idiot that will only give without giving anything in return," end quote. With the word idiot describing himself being a particularly notable insight into his psychological state at the time, and his likely sense of shame and embarrassment at having failed to achieve his regime's long-pursued goal of US normalization. And that sense of failure and embarrassment would quickly begin leading him to question the wisdom of even trying to carry on with that goal any further. Over the summer of 2021, reeling from the humiliation of the failed Hanoi summit and the economic devastation of the COVID-19 pandemic, Kim watched on as the United States disastrously pulled itself out of Afghanistan. In a matter of only 3.5 months, Washington's installed and propped up government in the country, who had received more than $81 billion in direct military aid and equipment, and whose armed forces had undergone decades of American training and supplies, just utterly disintegrated in the face of an offensive from the significantly outnumbered and under-equipped Taliban, completely destroying 20 years worth of American military effort in the country in virtually the blink of an eye. The scale of this fiasco almost certainly led to an idea in the minds of anti-American leaders around the world that after the past 30 years of global American dominance since the end of the Cold War, Washington's forces were finally going into global decline and retreat, and that other US-backed governments, regimes, and states could be equally as much of a paper tiger as the Islamic Republic of Afghanistan had ultimately turned out to be. It only took a few months after the Afghanistan calamity for Vladimir Putin to decide on launching his full-scale invasion of Ukraine. A war whose ultimate status continues to remain unclear nearly 3 years later, but which has presented another major challenge to the US-led global order. Russia was also immediately thrashed with a torrent of US and Western economic sanctions and trade restrictions over the invasion, which effectively made Russia just as much of an anti-Western pariah state as North Korea had already been for decades. And with that came a once-in-a-generation opportunity for Pyongyang. As the war in Ukraine began dragging on far longer than Russia initially anticipated, Russia began running low on its reserves of ammunition and manpower as the inferno on the front lines relentlessly consumed both kinds of resources. Unwilling to back down in Ukraine, and cut off from its access to trade with most of the rest of the outside world to acquire the resources it needed to continue fighting, it became increasingly clear that Moscow's only remaining options for wartime trade had been restricted to the handful of other countries who had already been totally cut off from the Western financial world: Iran, and especially North Korea. Having spent decades preparing for a conventional war with South Korea and the United States that so far hasn't come, North Korea likely possessed the largest arsenal of artillery munitions of any single country in the world. And with a direct land border crossing into Russia, Moscow quickly realized that it could essentially begin using the North Korean artillery arsenal as a massive rear base and supply source for their war in Ukraine, so long as it was willing to give the North Koreans what Pyongyang coveted in exchange. Most notably, Russia's significantly more advanced military technology relative to North Korea's frozen-in-time Soviet-era tech. For decades before this, nearly the entire world, including Russia, was united in restricting trade with North Korea because of the regime's nuclear weapons program, which kept the North's conventional military power crippled and frozen in time and restricted how advanced their missile and warhead delivery systems could really become. But after Russia was resoundingly cast out of the Western economic order over the Ukraine invasion, this long-standing calculus of cooperation was all thrown out the window, and Russia began openly embracing the North. The Russian defense minister personally visited Pyongyang in July of 2023. And then, Kim Jong-un himself boarded his train and traveled across the border to the Russian Far East to meet personally with Putin only a couple months later in September of 2023. And then, nearly a year later over the summer of 2024, Putin would ultimately return the favor with a personal visit to Pyongyang to meet with Kim again on his own home turf. The first time that Putin took a visit to North Korea in nearly a quarter century that resulted in the two leaders inking into paper a new and updated Russia-North Korea Mutual Defense Pact, legally pledging the two to defend and support one another in the event of an attack on either. And with that, North Korea had essentially and irrevocably given up on its long-standing goal of ever normalizing its relations with the United States, and had profoundly reoriented its foreign policy to realign itself with Russia again, like back during the Cold War era. It's currently unknown what, exactly, Kim and Putin have discussed in their past two in-person meetings since the invasion of Ukraine began. But open-source evidence and analysts from the U.S. State Department suggest that since mid-2022 to date, over the past two or so years, roughly 11,000 shipping containers have departed from North Korean ports, docked at Russian ports, and were then unloaded onto trains traveling westward. It is believed that most, if not all, of these shipping containers have carried munitions bound for the Russian army's use on the front line in Ukraine, with varying estimates of exact numbers involved. Lower-end Western estimates suggest that about 1.6 million North Korean artillery shells have found their way into the Russian army's hands over the past 2 years, while higher-end estimates believe it may be as many as 6 million artillery shells instead. Either way, Kim has almost certainly provided several billion dollars worth of artillery shells to Russia over the past 2 years, and they've potentially supplied even more artillery rounds to Russia than the United States has provided to Ukraine since the war began. These North Korean artillery shells, while likely of poor quality and questionable reliability, have nonetheless been of such an enormous quantity that they have delivered Russia the edge in artillery fire on the battlefield so far. They have provided Russia with a kind of bridging capacity, giving their guns on the front line millions of rounds to work with while their own domestic factories take time to retool and expand their own domestic production to begin replacing them. In October of 2024, The Times, citing Western intelligence sources, reported that roughly half of all the artillery shells being fired by the Russians in Ukraine were being provided by North Korea, and that North Korea had reached a capacity to provide Russia with about 3 million artillery shells per year, which has helped to fuel Russia's grinding advances in eastern Ukraine this past year that have resulted in slow but sustained gains in the Donbass theater. The big question, of course, is what has Russia provided to North Korea so far in exchange for all of this help? Beyond mere cash, food, and oil, resources that North Korea probably wants and needs, Pyongyang most of all wants access to Russian military technology to help boost their own armed forces' capabilities. And it appears in several ways that the Russians have already been assisting them here. Recent North Korean satellite launches appear to have deployed variants of Russian-built engines from their Angara family of rockets. And after two failed launches, North Korea managed to successfully deploy their first-ever spy satellite into orbit near the end of 2023. A few months later, in May of 2024, another attempted North Korean satellite launch featured a rocket with engines powered by low-oxygen kerosene propellant, something never before seen in North Korean rockets, but a common component of Russian rockets. With Pyongyang's demonstration that they can now successfully put satellites into orbit, it carries with it a certain implication that North Korea's ability to fire a nuclear-armed ICBM into space will also be able to survive atmospheric re-entry, a feat that was in severe doubt only a couple of years ago. More alarmingly, in June of 2024, North Korea tested a missile that featured a technology known as Multiple Independently Targeted Re-entry Vehicles, or MIRVs for short. Essentially a system that places several miniaturized nuclear warheads on the same missile that are capable of independently targeting different sites for an attack, which makes them significantly harder for missile defense systems to intercept or stop. North Korea truly being in possession of MIRV technology would enable them to genuinely challenge modern American anti-missile defense systems. And this sudden development seems to suggest that the Russians, who have long made use of MIRV systems in their own missiles, are almost certainly responsible for sharing the technology with them. Perhaps even more interestingly and potentially alarming, recent satellite imagery captured by Airbus and Maxar over Pyongyang's international airport appear to suggest that North Korea is busy converting an old Ilyushin IL-76 aircraft there into the country's first airborne early warning platform, or AEW. If they're successful, the AEW would enable North Korean commanders aboard to coordinate air and missile strikes, including nuclear strikes, and would also greatly improve North Korea's detection and radar capabilities, all of which is also likely being helped by Russia. Finally, and probably most importantly, North Korea desires access to Russian nuclear submarine technology. North Korea already has a large fleet of dozens of submarines, but they're all very old and outdated, and they're all conventionally powered by diesel engines, which means that when they're operating beneath the sea, their engine noises are loud and they're relatively easy to detect with modern technology, which restricts their stealth capabilities and effectively restricts their operating area to nearby North Korea's own coastlines without being detected for defensive purposes, rather than offensive purposes. However, in September of 2023, North Korea revealed a new ballistic missile submarine that it claims is capable of firing tactical nuclear-armed missiles while hidden beneath the sea, which, if true, would be the first time that North Korea has acquired this capability. The new sub is still conventionally powered, though, so even if it truly does have the capability to fire a nuclear-armed missile, its effective operating range would be restricted to within North Korea's own immediate waters. If it ventured too far outside of them, its loud engines would enable it to be tracked and it would no longer be capable of the element of surprise. Nonetheless, a nuclear-armed submarine operating somewhere hidden within North Korea's own nearby waters will still pose a massive headache for any potential wartime scenario, because prior to it being detected, it could still likely fire a nuclear missile from there that could strike just about anywhere in South Korea or Japan, including any of America's numerous military bases dotted throughout both of these countries, an ability that would give any serious military action against North Korea major reason to pause. The acquisition of a nuclear-powered and nuclear-armed submarine in North Korea's fleet would change this calculus completely, because a nuclear-powered submarine operates significantly quieter than a conventional diesel-powered sub does, and can also go decades without the need to ever refuel itself, which cuts down on the time the vessel needs to come back to port to refuel and resupply. Nuclear-powered submarines are far more stealthy and can operate for far longer periods of time, and can operate much further away from the mainland, which makes them much more strategically advantageous to have. Imagine a world where North Korea had a nuclear-powered submarine armed with nuclear missiles and hid it somewhere in the vastness of the Pacific Ocean. In theory, it could fire its nuclear-armed missiles from just about anywhere in the Pacific at major U.S. population centers in Guam, Hawaii, or even the U.S. West Coast itself. And if North Korea had multiple nuclear-powered submarines, they could rotate them in and out of port and maintain at least one constantly out on patrol and hidden, which could claim an entire American city like Los Angeles if they felt sufficiently threatened. This isn't the reality that has arrived just yet, but it is almost certainly the number one technological capability that North Korea would like to extract from Russia, who maintains the second largest fleet of nuclear-powered submarines in the world behind only the US itself. And it's probably also the capability that Russia would most like to not have to give up. And, as a permanent member of the United Nations Security Council, Russia can heavily support North Korea diplomatically as well. In the spring of 2024, Russia used its permanent position at the UN to block the renewal of the UN body that oversees the enforcement of sanctions on North Korea's nuclear and missile programs, which will almost certainly just make it even easier for North Korea to continue developing its nuclear weapons capabilities even further. Conventionally, North Korea's own military capabilities have rotted and languished since the end of the Cold War, and the decades worth of punishing sanctions imposed on it. North Korea spends a massive 36% of its entire GDP on its military spending, which is nearly the same as Ukraine currently spends with an ongoing existential invasion going on across its territory. But because North Korea's economy is so tiny and impoverished, the entire annual North Korean defense budget is equivalent to only 2 days' worth of the US military's current spending, while South Korea's military budget is larger than the entire North Korean economy combined is. North Korea's conventional forces, as they are now, can never challenge the US and South Korea in a one-on-one fight. And North Korea also knows that it doesn't really have much else to offer Russia in exchange for the more important technology, like nuclear submarine tech, other than its vast supply of artillery shells. They know that eventually, Russia will bridge their gap in artillery production and begin producing millions of artillery rounds themselves, and they will then no longer have as much of a need for North Korea's huge and low-quality stockpile. North Korea therefore knows that in order to expand the relationship with Moscow any further, and to gain the even more advanced technology, it needs to offer Russia up more than just artillery shells and missiles. It needs to offer Russia the only other thing that it has in massive abundance that Russia is now in a serious shortage of: its huge reserves of manpower and soldiers. In September of this year, the New York Times reported that approximately 115,000 Russian soldiers have been killed in action since the invasion of Ukraine began, and another 500,000 or so more have been wounded, representing more than 600,000 total net Russian military casualties suffered during 2.5 years of war in Ukraine. According to the Ukrainian General Staff, the pace of Russia's current advancements in Ukraine are costing them roughly 1,000 casualties a day, which means that these huge and continuing losses of manpower are creating a shortage of additional soldiers to throw onto the front lines. Russia could order up a full-scale general mobilization like Ukraine has already done, or even just another partial mobilization. But that would be extremely politically unpopular, since it would bring the costs of the war to more and more Russian civilians, including in the wealthy urban areas like Moscow and St. Petersburg that have so far largely been spared from bearing any significant costs. So, rather than calling up another politically sensitive and risky round of mobilization within Russia to acquire more manpower, Putin has maybe begun to calculate that the less costly option would be to effectively buy manpower from North Korea instead, by trading away even more technology for it. While Kim has likely calculated that in order to gain more goodwill with Russia and even more technology, he can fill Russia's needs for manpower, just like he's already done with Russia's needs for munitions. North Korea is arguably the most heavily militarized country in the world. Approximately 30% of the entire North Korean population is either actively serving in the military, in the reserves, or in a paramilitary force. All North Korean men are required to serve 10 years in the Korean People's Army, while all women are required to serve 8-year terms. The country has more than 1.3 million personnel in its active duty standing army, about the same as the United States and even more than Russia, So the country certainly has available manpower to spend, and beginning in October of 2024, reports began emerging of significant numbers of North Korean military personnel already within Russia. The Ukrainian military has recently claimed that Russia has begun forming a battalion of approximately 3,000 North Korean soldiers near its border with Mongolia that is intended to be deployed to the Kursk Oblast, where the Ukrainian military has invaded and occupied territory since August. Then, on the 15th of October, the Kyiv Independent reported that an unnamed Western diplomat estimated that there were already 10,000 North Korean soldiers present in Russia undergoing training and preparation for deployment, while unnamed Ukrainian military sources believe that they could be deployed to the front line by the end of the year. The South Korean defense minister chimed in and stated that he believed the reports of North Korean soldiers being present in Ukraine and Russia were, quote, highly likely. And then President Zelensky confirmed the presence of limited numbers of North Korean troops in the occupied regions of Ukraine as well. If these reports are accurate, they mark an incredibly significant escalation in the war in Ukraine, and they mean that Ukraine is being invaded by the armed forces of a second country now as well. Even if the reports of 10,000 North Korean soldiers preparing to be deployed somewhere around Ukraine are true, though, that's not really very many troops in the grand scheme of things, but they could only be the beginning. A sort of trial run where their usefulness will be tested by Russia. There will be significant language barriers and operational differences to overcome. And like North Korea's munitions, North Korea's soldiers are of questionable quality. North Korea's military hasn't seen any real combat experience in decades and is effectively green and untested. Their equipment is of questionable reliability, and their morale will be highly suspect, with the risk of North Korean soldiers being so far removed from home in Ukraine, simply deciding to take their opportunities to defect. If they can prove themselves to the Kremlin to be useful in some capacity, the potentially 10,000 North Korean soldiers currently reported in Russia undergoing training could end up only being the vanguard of a much larger contingent of them still to come. Rather than using them directly on the front lines in Ukraine itself, another and probably more likely option that the Russians are considering would be to use the North Korean troops as border guards, deploying them to Kursk and other border regions around Ukraine to free up more Russian soldiers from these locations and throw them onto the front lines in Ukraine instead, ultimately still enabling Russia to avoid another round of politically costly mobilization in the process. North Korea's supply of manpower to Russia in time could prove to tip the balance of the front lines in Ukraine, while Russia's payment of technology to North Korea for that service could ultimately prove to tip the geopolitical balance in Northeast Asia as well. Already since Russia's invasion of Ukraine began, North Korea's ballistic missile tests have skyrocketed, with the highest reported tests on record in 2022, 23, and in 24. The number of nuclear warheads actively in North Korea's arsenal today is unknown, but generally calculated by experts to be between 50 and 60 total warheads, the fewest number controlled by any nuclear-armed state. But one study from last year in 2023 by the Seoul-based Korea Institute for Defense Analyses estimated that the North's arsenal is closer to between 80 and 90 warheads, and that Pyongyang was seeking to acquire between 100 and 300 warheads over the long term, an arsenal that would be comparable to those thought to be possessed by India and Pakistan. And once North Korea has this much larger arsenal of warheads and they have increased capabilities to deliver them to targets, thanks to Russian technology sharing like more durable ICBMs, MIRVs, airborne early warning systems, and potentially sea-based ballistic missiles fired from submarines, North Korea will be able to much more credibly threaten its enemies with nuclear attacks and will establish a sort of nuclear shadow for itself that will permanently loom in the background of all future confrontations. Consider the nuclear shadow of Russia during the conflict in Ukraine as a preview of what this could end up looking like. Kim has watched on over these past nearly 3 years as the US and Western allies have been hesitant to give Ukraine more powerful tools to win against Russia, out of the fear of Russia's nuclear shadow and the risks of nuclear escalation. It took years for the Western allies to provide Ukraine with F-16 fighter jets, and the US has still refused to give Ukraine authorization to fire long-range missiles any deeper into Russian territory, and has consistently refused to deploy American boots on the ground in Ukraine out of similar fears. So imagine a situation in the not-too-distant future where North Korea's nuclear weapons arsenal is significantly larger and more capable, where North Korea has earned significant diplomatic goodwill and support from Russia, and where potentially tens of thousands or more North Korean soldiers and officers have experienced real-world modern combat in Ukraine and returned back home, And then, with all of these pieces moved into place, China independently decides to finally launch an invasion of Taiwan. For a variety of reasons, it is likely that if China decides on launching an invasion of Taiwan, it will take place sometime in the next 6 years prior to 2030, with the most dangerous and likely years being sometime between 2027 and 2030, by which time the war in Ukraine could potentially be largely concluded one way or the other, but potentially with a Russian victory of some type. If China ends up launching its invasion between these years, it is highly likely that the United States will directly intervene against China in support of Taiwan, and the biggest war of the 21st century between the two global superpowers will begin. With China's enormous armed forces bearing down on Taiwan, the US military will want to utilize all of its regional bases in East Asia to support Taiwan, including all of its military facilities and infrastructure located across South Korea, especially its Air Force bases located at Osan and Kunsan on the Korean West Coast. In order to either preemptively deny the US military from being able to use these bases against them or in retaliation for their use, China would have a massive wartime incentive to neutralize them. In addition, all of America's military bases located even closer to Taiwan in Okinawa and throughout the rest of Japan. To attempt and prevent this situation from happening, it is reasonable to assume that South Korea may declare neutrality in the conflict and deny the US military permission from utilizing its bases on South Korean territory for offensive purposes against China, in the hope of sparing direct Chinese attacks on South Korean territory. Even if this happens, though, Japan will almost certainly not remain neutral, and America's more strategically important military bases in Japan will most definitely not stay out of the fight. Which means that Chinese missiles fired at Japanese and American targets there will still have to fly over South Korean territory or nearby South Korea to strike them, which will still threaten American and South Korean forces there and give American anti-air systems in South Korea an incentive to shoot the Chinese missiles down. Given these circumstances, it is possible that China would encourage North Korea to launch its own attack on South Korea in order to distract and pin down US forces on the peninsula and to keep them out from the more pressing fight over Taiwan. And perhaps even more alarmingly, North Korea would have major incentives to carry out an attack under these circumstances even without direct Chinese encouragement. With the US military in Korea and elsewhere in East Asia enormously distracted by the Chinese attack on Taiwan, a much more nuclear-capable North Korea, armed and supported with Russian technology and diplomacy, might self-calculate that the time was finally right for an opportunistic attack on the South to try and force a military solution to the Korean question. As North Korea continues to reject South Korea as an illegitimate state and actively claims all of its territory and has now ruled out peaceful reunification as well. Even if it did not calculate that an opportunity had arisen, North Korea might still feel compelled to attack anyway out of fear, because the US military would likely surge huge numbers of reinforcements into South Korea during a Taiwan invasion scenario. And that surge could cause North Korea to fear that an attack on them would come during or after the war with China concludes, which could cause the North to calculate on a dangerous preemptive nuclear strike against that buildup. It is true that for the past several decades during an era of peace, China has preferred the status quo in Korea and has valued stability there and has worked together with the US to make sure that continues. But during a wartime scenario between China and the US, especially if China begins losing the war, then that calculus will begin to radically shift, and China could decide to forgo stability in Korea by encouraging a North Korean attack in order to take pressure off of their more important front in Taiwan. And North Korea would almost certainly not just stand by while its biggest trading partner and historical supporter faces a traumatic war loss that will decide the geopolitical balance in East Asia for the rest of the century. This is all why, if a war breaks out over Taiwan between the US and China, it is highly likely that the US will end up having to face a second front in Korea against the North Koreans as well. With the North Korea emboldened by the US military's distraction, with diplomatic and military support and potentially even active encouragement from both China and Russia, with the prior precedents of Afghanistan's collapse and Ukraine's potential defeat to Russia, and with their significantly more advanced nuclear weapons program that will deter any major retaliation against the regime for having launched the attack if it fails. But even if the war over Taiwan never ends up coming and the situation doesn't ever escalate that far, North Korea's rapidly advancing nuclear and missile program with all of the Russian technology they're getting will still enable them to sooner or later begin taking more and more dangerous conventional risks on their own accord as well, as they will come to fear Western retaliation less and less. Consider the most likely flashpoint for a future crisis erupting between the two Koreas: the Northern Limit Line, or the NLL, the maritime boundary between North and South Korea and the Yellow Sea that was created by the UN Command at the time of the armistice in 1953 that ended the fighting of the Korean War, but which has been heavily disputed by North Korea since 1999. With their own interpretation of the maritime boundary in the region looking more like this. The area in between their claimed maritime boundaries here is one of the most dangerous locations in the entire world, and is the scene of frequent clashes between them, including several recent incidents that have turned deadly and nearly escalated to war. In 2010, a South Korean naval vessel that was sailing nearby to the disputed area but well behind the UN-recognized line was likely torpedoed and sunk by a North Korean submarine, which killed 46 South Korean sailors aboard. Then a few months later in the same year, a South Korean artillery exercise fired within the disputed waters triggered the North Koreans to launch an artillery bombardment of the South Korean island of Yeonpyeong, which killed another 4 South Koreans and wounded 22 others. And all of that happened back when North Korea's nuclear weapons program was still in its rudimentary infancy phase, and it was significantly more isolated diplomatically with a cooperative China and Russia. Now, in the not-too-distant future, with all of the support from Russia it's getting and its much more advanced nuclear capabilities, assume that another crisis erupts in the disputed waters around the Northern Limit Line in the 2020s. In January of 2024, during the same speech when Kim Jong-un demanded the constitution be changed to remove any references to peaceful reunification and when he labeled South Korea as his regime's principal enemy, he was further quoted as saying, quote, "As the southern border of our country has been clearly drawn, the illegal northern limit line and any other boundary can never be tolerated. And if the Republic of Korea violates even 0.001 millimeters of our territorial land, air, and waters, it will be considered a war provocation." End quote. So imagine a scenario happening today or in the near future, like what happened on Yeonpyeong Island back in 2010. North Korea gets outraged over something South Korea or the US does in the region, and then begins bombarding Yeonpyeong Island with artillery again. Only this time, shortly after the shells stop raining down on the island, North Korean troops themselves unexpectedly land on the island, overrun the small local South Korean garrison, and occupy it. This limited assault on the south and a small occupation of a tiny island would be Kim's first major test of how far his conventional attacks can go under his newly Russian-provided nuclear shadow. What would happen next? If South Korea caved and did nothing out of fear of nuclear escalation, it would surely only encourage future and increasingly riskier North Korean attacks elsewhere. If South Korea decided to respond forcefully and sent their own aircraft and marines to the island to retake it from the north, what would then happen if North Korea decided to fire a nuclear missile into the uninhabited disputed waters or one of the nearby uninhabited small islands as a warning shot to try and coerce the south into backing down and leaving the island alone? With Russia a permanent member of the UN Security Council, would North Korea be able to count on their veto to override any formal UN condemnation or authorization for an intervention for doing so? At that point, would South Korea and the United States really press on and risk escalating the situation further, and millions of lives all over a tiny island with a population of fewer than 2,000 people? Or would they back down and cave to North Korea's nuclear blackmail and hand them a small but symbolic and significant victory? And what would North Korea be expected to do after that, emboldened more than ever before? North Korea could end up taking a page out of the Russian playbook in Georgia and Ukraine and begin just nibbling away at South Korea more and more aggressively, with its nuclear shadow always lurking ominously in the background, testing the limits of escalation and where the red lines will actually be drawn at, with the knowledge that the US will never respond too harshly out of a fear of triggering an overwhelming nuclear response, especially after having witnessed how the US has handled Putin's nuclear threats in Ukraine. It's for these reasons that the situation on the Korean Peninsula has gotten so much more dangerous recently, and why this time actually feels different to so many analysts than previous North Korean aggression has. I personally do not believe that a war with North Korea is imminent, nor is it inevitable. I believe that North Korea's leadership is rational, and I do not believe that North Korea would risk a major war with the South and the United States unless it sensed there was no other option, or it sensed a once-in-a-century opportunity had arrived if China ends up launching a major invasion of Taiwan. And even that isn't a guaranteed outcome. If the invasion of Taiwan never ends up coming, then the chances of North Korea going all the way to full-scale war are extremely small. But the chances of North Korea initiating microaggressions, like a conventional attack on a small South Korean island somewhere, will continue growing higher, and bear their own independent risks of escalation anyway. It is an increasingly serious risk that should not be laughed at and ridiculed, and it is something that the world should begin preparing itself for. Deterrence is the best way to prevent an attack from happening in the first place. But deterrence has failed multiple times elsewhere recently, and other wars have been launched that most outsiders felt were impossible or irrational. Russia invaded Ukraine despite most people believing that Putin was sufficiently deterred from doing so. And Hamas launched an attack on Israel despite most people believing that Hamas was sufficiently deterred from doing so, against an enemy that was orders of magnitude more powerful than them, a logic that is commonly applied to a hypothetical North Korean attack on South Korea as well. But if someone is backed too far into a corner with no clear and good way out, and they sense even the smallest possibility to break out of that corner, their odds of doing something that seems illogical to outsiders increases dramatically. I sincerely, truly hope that the entire premise of this video is dead wrong, and that I'm imagining all of this in my head. And I truly hope to God that someone in the comments of this video will explain why that's the case and debunk all of this. Because another war on the Korean Peninsula in the 21st century, if it happens, will result in the deaths of millions to perhaps even tens of millions of people, and could legitimately become the greatest disaster to befall humanity in our entire history. And every possible resource should be invested into ensuring that that reality can never possibly happen. Now, there's a lot of data that goes into producing these kinds of videos, whether it's visually showing the scope of the North Korean submarine-launched ballistic missile threat, detailing out how North Korea's military spending stacks up against the US and South Korea, or showing how Chinese-fired missiles during a Taiwan invasion scenario would likely threaten US military bases in South Korea. The ability to actually visualize raw data like this on the map instead of just reading about it in text format is exactly what makes learning about these kinds of complicated geopolitical subjects so fascinating to me. And it's why the Exploring Data Visually course is one of my favorite courses that I've ever taken with this video sponsor, Brilliant. They start out by teaching some real bare-bones fundamentals through interactive exercises and straightforward explanations. Then, as you progress, they bring these small concepts together into the bigger process. And soon enough, you have a decent grasp of what originally seemed like a daunting subject. And the same goes for all the other subjects that they cover, too. From calculus to AI, to computer science, advanced physics, geometry, and so much more. I think that Brilliant is perfect for the kind of person who genuinely loves understanding new things, as they get you to the level where you can apply the concepts you learn into your everyday life. And they also make learning super practical, because the courses break down into short segments of about 15 minutes. So you can easily use their app to make steady progress in learning while you're commuting or just have some free time. So, if you're the type of person who loves learning new things, you can try out everything Brilliant has to offer for free for a full 30 days by clicking the button here on your screen right now, or by visiting brilliant.org/reallifelore, or by clicking the link down below in the description. And best of all, you'll also get 20% off of an annual premium subscription. It's an incredible way to help support my channel and learn some cool new things at the same time. And as always, thank you so much for watching.